Changing subjects now, we're going to talk about mostly primary drying, a little bit secondary drying. So why do we pay particular attention to primary drying? Well, in most cases, it takes longer than any other part of the cycle. You know, in our world of contract manufacturing, when we're approached by a potential client, one of the first things we ask them is, how long is your freeze-dry cycle? Because in some cases, they will come to us with a freeze-dry cycle already developed. They don't ask us to develop either the formulation or the process. It's simply transferred to Bloomington. And any cycle that takes more than about 3 days is probably going to be a showstopper because, again, freeze-drying is such an important unit operation, and you don't want to tie up too much capacity for too long. So it's important in that regard. And it also presents the greatest risk to product quality. We've talked about eutectic melting and collapse and why you care. And those are things that take place during primary drying. Secondary drying, relatively trouble-free because all of the ice is gone at that point. Not that you don't need to pay attention to it, but it is a bit simpler. So I said before that we're going to talk about or be kind of focused on what we call a graphical design space approach. Even if you never do this kind of work, it's still useful to know the concepts behind the design space, the materials characterization, the heat transfer, the mass transfer, the equipment capability piece of that. All of that sort of come together in this design space, and it represents to me a better way to go about process development, because the traditional approach is largely by trial and error. In other words, you do a bunch of trial batches and you make changes in the shelf temperature and the chamber pressure, maybe the freezing procedure, and you ultimately come up with conditions that work. In other words, you produce a pharmaceutically acceptable product, and then you establish what's often called proven acceptable ranges. When we're talking about primary drying, we're talking about proven acceptable ranges of the shelf temperature and the chamber pressure. Basically, you put a box around the process conditions that you've chosen largely by trial and error. And it's fair to ask, well, what's wrong with that? It isn't so much that there's anything wrong with it, is that there's a better way to do it. Because if you follow the traditional sort of trial and error approach, you have no idea how near those process conditions are to optimum conditions. And when I talk about optimum conditions in primary drying, I'm talking about the conditions that give the fastest drying rate, fastest sublimation rate that's within the capability of the equipment. Okay, that would be optimum. If you do it by trial and error, you don't know where you are with respect to how close or how far you are away from an optimum set of conditions. And the other thing you don't know is really how close you are to product failure. So the approach that we advocate is identifying optimal conditions based on a thorough understanding of the process and find the edges of failure. Okay. And there are two edges of failure. There's an edge of failure that's associated with the product. Now that will be a collapse temperature or a eutectic melting temperature. There are cases where it might be something else. We've talked a little bit about powder ejection from a vial. It could be that there's an upper limit on the sublimation rate that you have to, if in the case of fluffy, not very cohesive freeze-dried solids, and you can't do anything about it, you may have to limit the sublimation rate just to avoid the potential for blowout. But there again, that's the exception. Usually, this line, this boundary on the design space is a collapse temperature or a eutectic melting temperature. This next, this blue line, again, is the equipment capability curve. That is the sublimation rate, again, sublimation rate on the y-axis, chamber pressure on the x-axis. That is the sublimation rate that this piece of equipment will support. And you can see that it's a function of the pressure in the system. Okay. And the optimum is the highest sublimation rate within this green shaded area, the highest point on the y-axis. So again, we know the optimum conditions, and we know where the edges of failure are. It's just much more scientifically sound, and it's based on first principles of heat and mass transfer, as well as conservation of energy. I don't think anybody's going to argue with any of those as a way to go about doing process development. So we've already talked about some of this. We characterized the formulation, and we identified the failure mode. Again, it might be eutectic melting. It might, I'll say a little bit about meltback because it's common industry jargon, but it's not very specific. Basically, it's a product where you can tell by looking at the product that it looks like it's melted at some point. But in fact, it could either be from melting, or even more likely, it's just collapse, because collapse will often look like material that has melted. I mentioned powder ejection from the vial. There may be other failure modes. I'm not quite sure what those would be. Okay. And then we determine the upper product temperature limit during primary drying. We've talked about thermal analysis. We've talked about freeze-dry microscopy a little bit, or Ruben will expand on that this afternoon. In addition to that, we like to do a series of trial laboratory batches where we try to make it fail, and where we're looking for failure based on visual observation of the freeze-dried product. I mentioned when we were talking about freeze-dried microscopy that you can't always tell. I mean, you can see partial collapse looking under a microscope, but you don't know whether that is going to be the kind of collapse that you can see when you look at the product. So we like to carry that a step farther, and we do a series of steps, or a series of trial runs under increasingly aggressive conditions, and we try to more precisely identify a product temperature that's associated with failure. There are some new pieces of equipment that have appeared recently that are sort of they're a mini freeze dryer. There's one that's made by Physical Sciences through SP Scientific, and there's also a micro freeze dryer that Nilrock makes. And the idea behind that equipment is that it allows you to do these kinds of runs when you don't have much API. We often deal with that, where there's not enough API available to do a run where you would fill one shelf of a LioStar freeze dryer, for example. So it allows you to do these runs. You can still control shelf temperature well. You would never do it on the kind of freeze dryer, where the manifold type freeze dryer, you just don't have the control over that process. So again, there's something worth doing. We have actually used both of those in our lab. Very good for what we call make it fail freeze dry runs. So then we want to establish the relationship between the process variables we control, that would be the shelf temperature and the chamber pressure, and the variable that you don't control, but it's the one that you care most about, and that is the product temperature. So the design space establishes that relationship between variables you control and the more important variable that you don't directly control. And we do that by measuring the vial heat transfer coefficient and the resistance of the dried product layer to flow of water vapor. We combine these with, again, basic equations for heat and mass transfer, and use that to construct this design space. Mechanisms of heat transfer, we've touched on it a little bit. I expect you know a lot about this, but conduction, that is the main mechanism for heat transfer in freeze drying, where we get heat by molecular motion between one differential volume element of a material and the next one. Convection can be either natural convection that from density differences, or forced convection, where there's some sort of impeller, some sort of a motive device to move fluid around. In either case, we're talking about heat transfer by bulk motion of some fluid, either a liquid or a vapor. I think I've mentioned before, there's difference opinion about whether convection really amounts to anything. I think at the low end of the operating range of freeze drying, you can pretty much ignore convection. At the higher operating, and that we in Bloomington we use as high as 400 millitorr. I expect that at the high pressure end of the operating range of freeze drying, convection probably does matter a bit. And then there's thermal radiation, which is electromagnetic radiation just that arises from thermal excitation of a material that we know to be important in some way, something we call the edge effect in freeze drying. You know, all of these equations for rate processes follow the same general form, where we have a flow term is equal to a driving force times a conductance term or divided by a resistance term. It's really the same idea. In this case, for heat transfer, the flow of heat is equal to a heat transfer coefficient here. The area of the vial matters. TS minus TB is the difference between the shelf surface temperature and the temperature of the product at the bottom of the vial or at the bottom of the slab of frozen material. Driving force, conductance, and a rate term. Mass transfer, again, rate of mass transfer. We use the term resistance of the dried product layer, but the driving force is the difference in pressure between the difference between the vapor pressure of ice at the sublimation front and the vapor pressure of ice that's on the condenser. So P sub I is the sublimation interface. P sub C refers to vapor pressure of ice on the surface of the condenser. Again, and we'll talk more about the resistance of the dried product layer. And then this is just conservation of energy. It says that the rate of heat transfer is equal to the rate of mass transfer times the heat of sublimation of ice, which is just over 2,800 joules per gram. Okay, so this approach assumes that we have a constant shelf temperature during primary drying. Why is that? Well, in my world, you know, we're working for clients that are just comfortable with doing it that way. They're accustomed to having a constant shelf temperature during primary drying, and there's a tendency to resist, even though we know that if you really want to optimize a freeze-dry cycle, you're not going to have a constant shelf temperature and you're not going to have a constant chamber pressure during that process. But this is, again, this is a developing approach and we will get there ultimately. But for right now, we're using a constant shelf temperature during primary drying. Okay. It also assumes that we have a constant value of the resistance of the dried product layer. Let me go back a minute. We know that the resistance of the dried product layer is not constant. It starts out at zero. And as the sublimation front recedes, it's going to increase its maximum just as the sublimation front reaches the bottom of the vial. We measure the resistance or the value of resistance we use for constructing a design space is the one that we measure as we approach the end of primary drying, okay? That's where the product temperature is highest because, again, the sublimation front is moving into a temperature gradient, and that's where the risk to product quality is the greatest. So we use the maximum value of R, which is the one that we calculate at the end of primary drying. And also, the other assumption is that in establishing the equipment capability curve for the laboratory or pilot dryer, we assume that we're going to fill the dryer up. That's just a conservative assumption because in production, in our world anyway, the freeze dryers are generally completely full. I mean, every shelf is completely occupied by vials, so we feel the need to follow suit. For laboratory and pilot equipment, even though it's the exception when we do a batch when the pilot freeze dryer is completely full. So with those as assumptions, we kind of move on with this. So the first thing we want to do is measure the vial heat transfer coefficient. So we fill the intended vial. Let's say that we know about what our fill weight's going to be. Let's say it's 6 mils in a 20 mil vial. We don't use the formulation. We just use water for the sake of simplicity. We're trying to get a measure of how efficiently that particular vial transfers heat. So we use one full tray of vials in our LioStar freeze dryer. We place thermocouples in the bottom center of vials. We found that it's sufficient to use at least three. And we carry out the freeze dry cycle. Now, we don't worry too much about the exact shelf temperature we use or the chamber pressure we use. We just would like to get it in the right ballpark for what we anticipate might be the final cycle. Now, we're going to come back to TDLAS in a little bit when we talk about process monitoring. In this work, in the work we do, we always measure mass flow rate by tunable diode laser absorption spectroscopy. How many are familiar with that? Couple. Okay. We'll talk about it more later. Basically, it's a near IR based in-process method that gives you the instantaneous sublimation rate. Very handy technology. And for us, it's kind of the centerpiece of our whole approach to constructing a design space. But you don't have to do that. Anybody familiar with the smart freeze dryer technology? Yeah. That you can use that as well. The smart freeze dryer is where you close the valve between the chamber and the condenser for a few seconds. You monitor the transient pressure response. You fit the experimental curve to a model, but basically by measuring that pressure rise, you can calculate the mass flow rate. We don't use it, but I understand that works fine. Okay. But at any rate, you need some way to measure the sublimation rate. You could do it gravimetrically if you want, just by weighing before and after, but it's quite a bit of work and it's kind of tedious. Okay. So you freeze the product, you establish a pressure set point, you let it equilibrate, and you measure the sublimation rate that corresponds to that pressure. Then you increase the pressure set point and get a new sublimation rate, and you keep that up until you've covered the selected pressure range. Now, when we do this, we typically would fill vials in the afternoon of one day, allow them to freeze overnight, and we can finish the experiment the next day. It may take less than a full day to do this, so it's not real time consuming. And then we calculate the vial heat transfer coefficient at each pressure. And it's pretty much kind of plug and shut. This is the heat of sublimation of ice. We use 2,803 joules per gram. This is the mass flow rate. This is the cross-sectional, the area of the outside vial, the outside diameter of the vial. This is the shelf surface temperature. This is the ice temperature, the product temperature that we determine from the thermocouples that we've placed in the vials that are filled with water. And we might generate a table then that looks like this. Now, we're typically not going to use this big of a pressure range, but we want to get at least 5 points here because this is not a straight line, and then we fit a curve to those, and that gives us the heat transfer coefficient as a function of pressure. So why would the heat transfer coefficient be a function of pressure? No penalty for wrong answers.
It's the driving mechanism, the pressure difference.
Well, yeah, but the reason the heat transfer coefficient is a function of pressure is that we talked about the series of resistances. You've got a resistance associated with the bottom of the vial and the frozen layer, but the controlling resistance is the contact resistance. It's the resistance that results from the fact that the vial is not in good thermal contact with the shelf. And it's pressure dependent because the higher pressure, the more water vapor molecules you've got bouncing back and forth between shelf and bottom of the vial and maybe the side of the vial to some extent. So for that reason, the higher the pressure, the higher the rate of heat transfer.
Okay.
Okay. So in terms of heat transfer, you're better off to operate at the highest pressure you can because transfer of heat from the shelf to the vial is more efficient at higher pressures. And again, that's why you see this continuing increase in vial heat transfer coefficient as a function of pressure. Okay, so now we're going to measure the resistance of the dried product layer. That's given the designation R sub P. Instead of using water, we fill our vials with the correct volume of the formulation and run a trial cycle. Again, we put thermocouples in at least three vials, being careful how we locate the thermocouple in the center of the vial, touching the bottom. We monitor mass flow rate either by TDLAS or the smart freeze dryer. More about that later. And then calculating RP is pretty simple arithmetic. It's equal to the area of the product. That's the inner area, inside radius of the vial. It's that part that's covered by the product. This P sub I is the vapor pressure of ice at the sublimation front. And I misspoke earlier. I said that's pressure of the condenser. It's actually the pressure in the chamber. We express that in torr. And this, again, is the mass flow rate. Now, we have to express the vapor pressure of ice in terms of temperature. So we substitute for P with a subscript I this expression, which is just the relationship between vapor pressure expressed in torr in terms of product temperature. But aside from that, it's pretty simple arithmetic. Here's an example of the process data we would use for this measurement, paying particular attention to the product temperature. Again, during primary drying, all of the thermocouples are running together. We collect our data back here. We don't want to get into secondary drying or we'll get artifactual data. This is the chamber pressure. What's the shelf temperature? Maybe I'm not showing it on here. It doesn't really matter. And so this is a graph then of resistance of the dry product layer as a function of time during primary drying. I said before that the value we want to measure is the resistance as the product approaches the end of primary drying. It goes up at the end, not because the resistance is increasing, but because the drying rate is slowing down. We're done with primary drying. So typically, we'll draw a tangent to these. We'll draw a line like this, and then a line like this, and we'll pick a value here as a resistance of the dried product layer. And it's going to be about between 3 and 3.5 expressed in the units of resistance of the dried product layer. So again, we just run a trial cycle, use that process data to calculate resistance of the dried product layer. Now we construct the shelf temperature and product temperature isotherms. So we start by choosing an arbitrary value for temperature of the shelf, and we usually start at the low end of the pressure range of interest. We calculate for a given shelf temperature and chamber pressure the corresponding value of temperature of the product, again measured at the bottom of the vial, and the corresponding mass flow rates. Now here we're just combining equations that I went through earlier, the fundamental equations for heat transfer and mass transfer. And then again, we've got to substitute this expression for P sub I. So basically, this equation, that shouldn't be a, that should be a delta. Somehow that didn't transfer. That this is the heat of sublimation known, area of the product known. That's not known. This is known. We've calculated that. We've calculated this. We know the outside area of the vial. Temperature of the shelf. Okay, so we've got one equation with two unknowns. What complicates it a little bit is what we're trying to calculate, the temperature of the product, as appears as a part of an exponential term on one side of the equation and as part of a linear term on the others, which means we can't really separate variables and solve it analytically. We have to do it, but basically do that iteratively. And our friend Mike Pakal, back in the mid-80s, developed this Lyo calculator. He wasn't thinking about design space or batch behavior of materials at the time. He was basically building an expression that would describe the time dependence of the movement of the sublimation front through an individual vial of product, but it doesn't matter. He just used Excel to solve this equation. So it makes it easy, to do this. So, we've solved for TB. Spreadsheet that I sent you has that in it. And I'll give you a couple of case studies tomorrow just so you can work through that and see how we get the design space using that data. So we've solved for the temperature of the product. We calculate the corresponding mass flow rate just with this equation. Then, so that gives us one value of sublimation rate for one shelf temperature and one chamber pressure. Now we choose a new value of chamber pressure and repeat the process. We do that for at least five values of chamber pressure, and we get this. This is one shelf temperature isotherm. What does it tell us? It tells us the relationship between sublimation rate and pressure for that formulation in that vial at a shelf temperature of 0 degrees centigrade. Then we pick a new shelf temperature and we do this all again until we like to get at least four shelf temperatures. That's how we construct the shelf temperature isotherms. Now we need to put in the product temperature isotherms. We pick an arbitrary product temperature that we're going to pretty much know. We're going to know the right ballpark from the preliminary work that we've done. And a chamber pressure. Okay. Calculate the sublimation rate under these conditions. Again, just with this equation. We only need 2 points. Product temperature isotherms are linear, so they go pretty quickly. Just 2 pressure points and add those, and we get isotherms that look like this. Now, one of these isotherms, we need to make sure that we include as one isotherm the upper product temperature limit during primary drying that we've determined by other means. And we will make one of these a solid red line, and that is the product related failure point or the boundary of our design space. Keep in mind, both KV and RP are batch average values. They're not individual vials, okay? And they're not necessarily the same from vial to vial, although they should be close, and we'll need to talk a little bit about this edge effect because it's important to keep that in mind. The edge effect derives from thermal radiation from the door of the freeze dryer and the side walls. In terms of heat transfer by thermal radiation, when radiation strikes a surface, there's several things that can happen. It can be transmitted, it can be absorbed, or it can be reflected away. And the basic laws are the Stefan-Boltzmann law. This is the heat flow rate, Stefan-Boltzmann constant. Notice that heat transfer by radiation is proportional to the fourth power of the absolute temperature. We introduce the thermal emissivity, a value between 0 and 1, that's characteristic not only of the material, but the surface finish of the material as well. Generally, the shinier the surface, the lower the thermal emissivity. So heat transfer by thermal radiation depends mostly on temperature and to some extent on thermal emissivity. Again, that value is going to be somewhere between 0 and 1. This is a sublimation rate mapping for a laboratory scale freeze dryer where this is the door side. These are the side walls. This is the rear. My point is simply that it's not the same from vial to vial. Here in the back, the vial to vial, consistency in sublimation rate is pretty good, but notice that it's significantly higher on the edges and it's significantly higher. Actually, the highest values are in the front. Because we have a plexiglass door. Most laboratory freeze dryers use a plexiglass door. And that has a pretty high thermal emissivity, somewhere around 0.94, 0.95, something like that. So we tend to get the highest sublimation rate right in the front of the freeze dryer. I didn't complete the reference there. This is Mike Pakalin, his graduate student at the time, Shalaja Ramhotla. they did, I thought, was kind of a clever experiment where they took some vials and they sputter coated them with gold. So they got these nice, really pretty, shiny gold vials. They used that to sort of confirm the idea that this edge effect really arises from thermal radiation. So what they did was compare sublimation rates between coated and uncoated vials, both at the edge of the array and back here in the center of the array. Again, the emissivity, it's not obvious, but glass has a high thermal emissivity. I think that's also around 0.5 or so. By sputter coating them with gold, they reduced the thermal emissivity of the vial to about 0.3. So they made a pretty dramatic reduction. So if heat transfer by radiation is a big deal, you should see a big difference between the sputter coated and the non-sputter coated glass vials. And I have to remind myself about the key here, but she used three different shelf temperatures, minus 25, minus 15, and 0 degrees, looking at sublimation rate here. And they compared then clear vials located in the front of the chamber with clear vials located in the center, then gold-coated vials in front, gold-coated vials in the center. Well, the uncoated vial gave a significantly higher sublimation rate relative to the gold-coated vials also on the edge of the array. Again, confirming that, yes, that this edge effect is explained by thermal radiation. If you take that pair of vials and put them in the center of the array, the gold-coated vials a little bit higher, but not really significantly different, probably because in the center of the array, they're pretty well protected from thermal radiation from the edge or from the front anyway. So they're shielded. And a pretty big percentage difference, certainly in this case, between the clear vials and the gold-coated ones. Now, at minus 15, you still have the same general pattern, but it doesn't seem to make quite as much difference. And the idea is that the lower the shelf temperature that you're carrying out primary drying, the bigger a deal that the edge effect is. As we get to higher temperatures, yes, there's a difference, but the higher the shelf temperature, the less relatively important the thermal radiation effect is. And again, we have to keep in mind that we're not controlling the temperature of the sidewalls. We're controlling temperature of the shelf. So the greater the difference between the shelf temperature and the walls, the greater the relative contribution of thermal radiation and the greater the edge effect. I thought it was a nice piece of work, and it answered that question, I think, pretty definitively. Sources of uncertainty in this approach. Well, I've said before that we assume a constant shelf temperature during primary drying. That's not really so much a source of uncertainty as it is maybe a limitation on the technique. The demand on equipment capability is generally highest early in primary drying. We haven't had a chance to build up much resistance to mass transfer yet. So we've got sort of opposing effects there. Early in primary drying, we have a big demand on equipment capability. It's going to slow down as we proceed. But risk to product is greatest late in primary drying. And something that I forgot to put in here, and you should, is that, again, as I've said, both KV and R sub P are batch average values. So the more the scatter in individual vial heat transfer coefficients and individual vial resistance, the more cautious you have to be and the more conservative you have to be in actually identifying the optimum primary drying conditions. So the next step, the last step then, is to add the equipment capability curve. Again, I've said before that any freeze dryer has a limit as to the sublimation rate it will support, and it is going to be a function of pressure for the most part. So it's important to understand equipment capability both at laboratory and production scale. Some factors that can limit performance include refrigeration capacity, maybe, condenser surface area, maybe. There's going to be some limit as as far as how high you can get the shelf temperature. In our, you know, the Lyostar freeze dryers, it's about 45 degrees or so. And it can be limited by the dynamics of vapor flow from the chamber to the condenser, what we call choked flow, which is a very common limiting factor. And it's just based, I'm giving you a simplified version here, that there's a speed limit for velocity of water vapor from the chamber through this duct to the condenser, which is the speed of sound in that system. As you approach choked flow, the mass flow rate through this constriction becomes independent of pressure on the downstream side. And I think I told you earlier about a scale-up study that we learned the hard way about the importance of choked flow, because when a fairly aggressive cycle that had been developed in the lab was scaled up to production equipment, they found that they couldn't control the pressure. So they had to go back and sort of rethink things. But it also, we learned a valuable lesson about understanding choked flow as a scale-up issue in freeze drying. So how do you measure the equipment capability? There are two methods. One is called the choke point method. One is called minimum controllable pressure. This is my colleague, Jayashree Srinivasan. To do this, we take a tray ring and we take a trash bag out of the janitor's closet that's close by, and we just line this tray ring with plastic, and she's just using binder clips to clip the plastic on the upper part of this tray ring. We're in a three shelf configuration here. We put about 2 liters of water on each shelf. We typically let that freeze overnight and then start testing the next morning. So for the choke point method, we take a known quantity of water into each line tray ring. We freeze slabs overnight, typically minus 50 degrees. We evacuate to the low end of the pressure range. That's usually for us about 30 millitor. We don't generally go much below that. It's hard to get much below that, in fact. And once steady state is established at the pressure set point, we make stepwise increases in shelf temperature until the pressure exceeds the set point. And then this is the choke point at that pressure. Okay? We note the mass flow rate of water vapor, either TDLAS or smart freeze dryers, fine. And we also keep track of the condenser pressure as well. I'll show you some representative process data here momentarily. Then we establish a new pressure set point, let the system reach steady state, and repeat the process. Continue making small changes in the shelf temperature until pressure exceeds the set point. And then we continue this process until the pressure range of interest has been covered, okay? Then we always like to check on our TDLAS. We know how much ice we're putting into the each tray, and then the TDLAS instrument keeps track of the total amount of ice that's been removed, and we want to make sure that those numbers agree, or at least within reason. And compare with the TDLAS total, we find that we're generally in this kind of testing within about 1% between gravimetric measurement, you know, the mass of water loaded minus the ice that's recovered when the testing is complete. Minimum controllable pressure is similar. Again, we start the same, freeze overnight, minus 50 degrees. We evacuate the system. We set the chamber pressure at some point that's below what we're ever going to reach. We're not going to get as low as 10 millitor. So we put the pressure set point there. We allow the system to reach steady state, and we record the mass flow rate of water vapor. Okay? This flow rate then corresponds to the minimum controllable pressure at that shelf temperature. Again, we want to note the condenser pressure. So again, we're starting at the low end of the shelf temperature range, and we make stepwise changes in the shelf temperature and allow a new steady state pressure to be established. We're well above the set point of the pressure, so we're letting the pressure in the system be whatever it will be. One note is that we need to make in our lab, the TDLAS instrument doesn't talk to the freeze dryer, so we always have to make sure that the pressure set points on the freeze dryer and the TDLAS agree. So that's just a an experimental detail. Representative process data looks like this. The black line is the shelf temperature. This blue line is the condenser pressure. The red line is the chamber pressure. I think it's noteworthy that we're getting, except early in the process, we can see that the line goes, it gets out of control. I'm not sure why this is true, but we started out at minus 50. We increased the shelf temperature to minus 47, and the pressure immediately went up above the set point of 30 millitorr. And the mass flow rate, the green line is mass flow rate. I'm not sure why that happened, because then we made step changes back down, went back down to minus 50, and we continued making these step changes in the shelf temperature. Notice a couple things. Notice how the chamber pressure, the red line, is really steady, but the condenser pressure, the blue line, oscillates. And the blue line, the condenser pressure, and the mass flow rate, the green line, are oscillating together. In fact, when one goes down, the other one goes up. And we find that we reach a point as we increase the shelf temperature where the condenser pressure just stays at some low value, well below 10 millitorr. And I think, Alina, we agreed that we get that pressure because that pressure represents a combination of the low end of the vacuum pump capability plus whatever the vapor pressure of ice is on the condenser, right? And we reach a point where it doesn't oscillate anymore. I think it's interesting, though, that this flow would appear fully choked, but we haven't yet exceeded the set point. We're still controlling at 30 millitorr, but we still take this as the choke point at that pressure, okay? I think the chamber pressure reading arises from the fact that in the Lyostar freeze dryer, the condenser pressure gauge is not mounted directly to the condenser. It's mounted in the foreline of the vacuum pump. And I think these spikes represent injection of nitrogen into the system for chamber pressure control. It surprises me that the chamber pressure can be so smooth, and we're seeing all of this oscillation in the condenser pressure. It sort of begs the question, what would the condenser pressure look like if the gauge were mounted directly on the wall of the condenser? I don't know, but I'd like to find out. So basically, this would tell us the choke point. Notice how this is a pretty much steady state value of mass flow rate at that temperature. So it just becomes a matter of repeating that experiment. This takes a while. It takes a full day at least. When the condenser pressure bottoms out with no spikes, the mass flow rate reaches steady state. In this case, something over 38 grams per hour. That corresponds to a shelf temperature of minus 40 degrees. The chamber pressure is still under control at this point. Okay, then we establish a new pressure set point, repeat the whole process. So we'll basically generate a table of mass flow rate versus chamber pressure. Now, the minimum controllable pressure process data looks more like this. I don't have a shelf temperature on that to show you, and the condenser pressure, I don't have it on here, but it runs right along here. It's running well below 10 millitorr, and there are no oscillations. So it says that the flow is fully choked this whole time. The black line is mass flow rate. The blue line is chamber pressure. So basically, we just match these up, the steady state values, so we can then generate a table of flow rate versus minimum controllable pressure, which we take to be the choke point for that system. This experiment goes a lot more quickly, and we find that if we superimpose the data points, these values are determined by choke point. The sort of yellow orangish ones are determined by minimum controllable pressure. The point is, they all give the same result. So in our hands, anyway, minimum controllable pressure is the quickest, easiest and best way to generate an equipment capability curve. Okay. The relationship between the controlled variables, the shelf temperature and chamber pressure and product temperature is typically established on the laboratory scale. Once you've established that relationship, the capability of a laboratory scale freeze dryer really doesn't matter. What matters is the capability of the equipment that you're going to be manufacturing that product on. And there's a big need in the industry for better understanding of production scale freeze dryers. But you would go about testing it in the same way. Just a few words. I'm going to wrap up here in about another minute about secondary drying. We'll talk more about comparative pressure measurement tomorrow. It's a cycle monitoring technique that we really like, where we're comparing two different pressure gauges, a thermal conductivity type gauge with a capacitance manometer type gauge. This represents primary drying, where we're subliming ice. This drop indicates the end of primary drying. This is just the apparent pressure, not the real pressure. It approaches the capacitance manometer. At this point, we're done with primary drying. We increase the shelf temperature to the secondary drying temperature, in this case, 35 degrees. And the apparent pressure goes up again because we're driving off the unfrozen water. It goes up, it reaches a maximum, and then it tails back off, ultimately meets up with the capacitance manometer pressure. And at that point, the cycle is done. The nice thing about this is it's giving you information about what the product is doing without the uncertainty associated with putting temperature measuring probes in individual vials of product. It's common practice in the industry at secondary drying to decrease the pressure in the chamber to the minimum value. That's based on the mistaken idea that secondary drying is enhanced by the lowest pressure you can get, because in essence, or the mental picture is, the low vacuum is sucking the unfrozen water out of the amorphous material. In fact, that's not true at all. Both published data and our own experience in the lab says that neither the rate of secondary drying nor the extent of secondary drying is influenced by chamber pressure. It really doesn't matter. Probably because the rate limiting step in that rate operation is diffusion of water molecules in the amorphous material, which is independent of pressure. So it doesn't really matter what the pressure is during secondary drying, at least as far as we can tell. Useful to know, and because we always have to deal with deviations in production, and some of those deviations are pressure deviations. If they happen during secondary drying, as long as there's not a breach of asepsis, it really shouldn't influence or present any real risk to product quality. And we're done, and it's 5 o'clock, and you've probably had about enough of this for one day. So we'll pick this up again. What are we doing tomorrow?